Chapter 5. Artists' Crimes. It was a chilly, grey September morning in the year 1598 when two men faced one another with murder in their minds in Hoxton Field, Shoreditch. In those far-off days of the first Queen Elizabeth, Shoreditch was not a slum on the edge of London's East End. It was an area of open fields to the north of the city wall. One of the two duellists was an actor called Gabriel Spencer. The other was a writer, Ben Jonson. Jonson was a powerful, stockily built man in his mid-30s. His opponent was taller, stronger and younger, and his rapier was 10 inches longer than Jonson's. At a signal, they crossed swords and began to fight. Spencer attacked violently and within a few minutes had wounded Jonson in the arm. Jonson lowered his sword. His second thought he was going to concede defeat. Then, with a burst of savage energy, he fought on, driving Spencer back by sheer physical weight. A sudden quick thrust, and Spencer staggered, dropped his rapier, and slowly crumbled. He was dead before he hit the ground, pierced in the right side. And Ben Jonson, one of England's greatest playwrights, joined the small company of men of genius who've deprived fellow human beings of life. It would have been a pity if Jonson had lost the fight. Only 2 days before, he had become famous. His play, Every Man in His Humour, was presented at the Curtain Theatre in Shoreditch by a company called the Chamberlain's Men. Its chief actor was another young playwright, whose name appears on the bill as Will Shakespeare. He was already the successful author of plays like The Merchant of Venice and Henry IV. But Jonson's triumph temporarily eclipsed him, and it was this that led to the duel. Jonson was a member of a rival group of players, the Admiral's Company, who regarded him as just a hack writer. So he offered the play he knew to be a masterpiece to the Chamberlain's Men, perhaps urged on by his old friend Shakespeare. The success angered Gabriel Spencer, a notoriously fiery actor who'd already killed a man in a fight, and he made loud and sneering remarks about base fellows who betrayed their master to rival houses. That was enough for Jonson, who also had a quick temper. Fortunately, he won, but even so, the duel almost cost him his life. He was thrown into Newgate Jail, accused of murder, and then had to appear in court in a street called Old Bailey. The jury lost no time in finding him guilty, and the sentence would have been death. But at this point, Jonson pleaded benefit of clergy. He was not, of course, a clergyman, but in the Middle Ages only the clergy could read, so anybody who was able to read could call themselves a clergyman and then demand to be tried by an ecclesiastical court. By Jonson's time, it had become a convenient way of avoiding the death sentence. Jonson was handed a book to prove that he could read, and then sentenced to be branded with a T for Tyburn, the place where felons were hanged, on his left thumb. He went on to write some of the greatest comedies in the English language, and according to legend, he was the indirect cause of the death of Shakespeare. He called on his old friend at Stratford in 1616, and the two went out drinking, after which they fell into drunken slumbers under an apple tree. Shakespeare caught a chill and died. Jonson lived on for more than 20 years. There are very few men of genius who have been guilty of murder, or even, like Jonson, manslaughter. This may seem to be mere chance. After all, both murderers and men of genius form a fairly small portion of the population, so it's hardly surprising if the two categories seldom coincide. But the real reason lies deeper. It's hinted at by George Bernard Shaw when he comments that we judge an artist by his highest moments, a criminal by his lowest. The characteristic of the man of genius is a certain patience and far-sightedness. He knows he may not succeed tomorrow, or next month, or even next year, but he has to keep on. Even when he has achieved success, his next work may be so advanced and difficult that his admirers may reject it as incomprehensible, like Beethoven's last and deeply religious quartets. What he needs to keep going is a certain faith, and knowledge that what he's doing is right. The criminal, on the other hand, lacks this kind of deep patience. His motto is, I want it now. If he wants sex, his natural impulse is to seize a girl and rape her. If he wants to be rid of his wife, his natural impulse is to kill her. If he wants money, he reaches out and tries to grab it. To satisfy his desire, he's willing to turn his back on the community and to commit an antisocial act. Yet, paradoxically, he also wants to be accepted by society, to be liked, respected. This is why the Cray brothers took every opportunity to be photographed with celebrities. It follows, then, that the basic psychology of genius, the patience, the intuition, the ability to listen to an inner voice, is the exact opposite of that of the criminal. The German novelist Thomas Mann always insisted that the artist and the criminal have a great deal in common, and he wrote a delightful novel, Felix Krull, Confidence Man, to illustrate his assertion. But Felix is just a charming rogue who never does anything truly wicked. The novel only proves that Mann knew very little about the psychology of a real criminal. He could have learned about it by studying the career of one of the few artistic killers known to criminal history, Pierre-François Lassonnière, executed in January 1836 for murder. Lassonnière's famous memoirs represent him as a ruthless enemy of society, who wrote that after his first crime, "I no longer belong to myself, but to cold steel." In other words, to the guillotine. The truth is that Lassonnière was a third-rate poet and a hopelessly incompetent criminal. His most ambitious job was an attempt to murder and rob a bank messenger, which he bungled. His motive for becoming a criminal was not heroic defiance of a corrupt society, but self-pity because his parents preferred his elder brother. He started by believing, perhaps correctly, that his parents owed him love. He ended by believing, incorrectly, that society owed him a living and a position. The memoirs reek of self-pity. Perhaps the most significant words in the book are his comment that he had decided that his life would be a form of slow suicide. The memoirs of Lassonnière had an important influence on another great writer who was fascinated by crime, the Russian Fyodor Dostoevsky. When he was the editor of a magazine, Dostoevsky deliberately published the memoirs to increase circulation. And the author of The House of the Dead was deeply interested in this notion of a man of talent who considers himself at war with a corrupt society. He translated it onto an altogether higher level in Crime and Punishment, in which Raskolnikov, a young and talented student, feels that it's hopeless poverty that prevents him from achieving anything worthwhile, and decides to give himself a start in life by killing and robbing an old woman pawnbroker. In fact, following the double murder, he's forced to kill the woman's sister as well. Raskolnikov realises that he has destroyed something in himself. He's further away than ever from being able to give expression to his genius. He surrenders to the police and undergoes the purgatory of imprisonment in Siberia before he can escape the consequences of his crime. It sounds like a typical piece of moralistic propaganda, but Dostoevsky had understood something profoundly important about the creative process. It is the very opposite of the destructiveness of the criminal. There have been many writers who've written violent and negative books, the Marquis de Sade, for example, but it's significant that de Sade never murdered anyone. In fact, the only people he tortured were prostitutes whom he paid. The fact is that, in spite of their sickening violence, de Sade's books are too intelligent, too creative, for their author to have actually killed or tortured anyone. It happens to be a simple fact of literary history that no great writer, not even a less-than-great writer, has ever committed cold-blooded murder. Perhaps the only known case of a man of genius committing murder is that of the Italian composer Gesualdo, who caught his wife in bed with a lover in the year 1590 and dispatched both with his sword. He also murdered the second child of the marriage, in case he was not the father. No modern court would find him guilty of first-degree murder. It was obviously a crime passionnel, added to which Gesualdo was undoubtedly mentally unbalanced. His strange, neurotic madrigals have gained new popularity in the 20th century because they sound so modern, so unlike the balanced, harmonious music of his contemporaries like Monteverdi. Dostoevsky himself is believed to have committed a crime, although there's no definite evidence. In two of his novels, characters are haunted by memories of having raped a 10-year-old girl. The internal evidence of his work suggests that Dostoevsky may well have done so, although most of his biographers are agreed that if it actually happened, and was not a figment of his masochistic imagination, then the girl was procured for him by a corrupt governess or brothel keeper, and that therefore his crime was not, technically speaking, rape, but carnal knowledge of a minor. There's always at least one major exception to a rule. Now, the exception to the rule that artists are never killers appeared in modern Japan. It was at mid-afternoon on January the 26th, 1948, that a man walked into the Shionomaki branch of Tokyo's Imperial Bank and introduced himself as Dr. Jiro Yamaguchi of the Welfare Department. The bank was about to close, and the last customer had already left. Yamaguchi was shown into the manager's office. The doctor, a neatly dressed man with a mole on his cheek and a scar on his chin, explained that the American occupation forces under General MacArthur were concerned about a dysentery epidemic, and that every employee in the bank would have to take a dose of preventative medicine. The manager, Mr. Yoshida, called 14 clerks into the office and introduced the doctor. He told them to fetch their teacups and carefully poured into each a quantity of liquid from a bottle, telling them to swallow it quickly. They all did. Some began coughing and complained that it burned. The doctor poured them another medicine and told them to swallow it like the first. Some employees went to get water to gargle. Then they began collapsing. The doctor had given them a solution of the deadliest of poisons, potassium cyanide. The fake doctor helped himself to the cash that was lying around, a mere $400 or so, and walked out, leaving 12 dead people lying on the floor of the bank. Three others, including the manager, were still alive. Stomach pumps saved their lives. Inspector Ohori of the Tokyo Police Department was astounded to discover that this was not the first time a fake doctor had tried to administer medicine to bank employees. It had happened the previous October at the Ibara branch of the Yasuda Bank, when 18 clerks had been severely ill after drinking a poison given by a welfare department official. The cyanide had not been strong enough to kill them, and the man had fled. Just over a week before the murders, a bank manager had become suspicious of a doctor who tried to administer medicine against dysentery, and the man had run away. Yet neither of these cases had been reported to the Tokyo police, only to local district police. The day after the mass murder, a man cashed a cheque stolen from the bank, but again escaped unnoticed. No Dr. Yamaguchi could be located. However, the man who had administered the poison at the Ibara Bank had left a card with the name Dr. Shigeru Matsui. There was a doctor of that name in Sendai, and he recognised that the bandit had used one of his own cards. This gave the police a lead. How had the bandit obtained it? In March of 1947, Dr. Matsui had attended a medical meeting and had handed out no less than 96 cards. It's a Japanese custom, to other doctors. The recipients had in turn given Dr. Matsui their cards, and the doctor, in his methodical Japanese way, had kept all of these. The police set about tracking down the 96 men. One of them was an artist named Sadimacha Hirasawa. His description corresponded closely with that of the wanted bandit. He had a mole on his left cheek and a scar under his chin. Otherwise, Hirasawa seemed at first an unlikely suspect. A respectable painter, head of a national art association, he had met Dr. Matsui on a ferry, and Dr. Matsui had been impressed because Hirasawa mentioned that he was taking a picture to present to the Crown Prince. Closer examination, however, revealed reasons for believing that Hirasawa could be their man. He had given his wife 80,000 yen just after the robbery, that's about $150, and deposited another 44,400 yen in his bank. Yet a few days earlier, he'd been trying to borrow money. Hirasawa claimed the cash had come from selling pictures and from patrons, but no sales or patrons could be traced. One industrialist admitted buying a painting for about $5, which seems to indicate that the artist was not making a fortune. Employees at the banks identified Hirasawa as the robber, although others were unsure. Hirasawa insisted that he had received most of the money from the president of an industrial corporation. But when the police discovered that the president had been dead at the time he was supposed to have paid the money, Hirasawa suddenly confessed. "You're right. No one can obtain money from a dead man. I am the man." Even so, the trial aroused great controversy, many people refusing to believe that an artist could be responsible for a mass murder. Hirasawa later withdrew the confession, claiming it had been extorted by police brutality. Although he was sentenced to death, the sentence was not carried out, and Hirasawa was, in effect, sentenced to life imprisonment. If indeed Hirasawa were guilty, and there are still many who believe he's the victim of a miscarriage of justice, then he would be the only example of an artist who had killed calculatedly and in cold blood. Even Lassonnière's murders, at least two, were spur-of-the-moment affairs done in the course of robbery. Artists are often capable of violence, for talent almost invariably involves high dominance, and most dominant people are prone to impatience and sudden fits of anger. The painter Van Gogh tried to stab Gauguin with a knife when they were sharing a house in Arles. But when Gauguin turned round, Van Gogh went back to his room and cut off his own ear with the knife. The attack on Gauguin was the outcome of artistic frustration, the frustration that finally led him to suicide. The list of artists, composers and writers who have been victims of violence is altogether longer and more varied. Another of Ben Jonson's contemporaries, the dramatist Christopher Marlowe, was killed under mysterious circumstances. On Wednesday, May the 30th, 1593, Marlowe was dining with three companions in a tavern at Deptford, South London. They had been drinking all afternoon, and at 9 in the evening, Marlowe and a man called Ingram Fraser had some dispute about the bill. Marlowe was lying on a bed behind Fraser's chair, when, according to the others, he suddenly seized Fraser's dagger and struck him. Fraser snatched back the dagger and struck back, the weapon entering above the right eye, killing Marlowe instantly. It sounds like a simple case of manslaughter, except that two of the three men present were rather dubious characters. One was a spy, the other a cutpurse, while the third, Fraser himself, was employed by Sir Thomas Walsingham, the Queen's spymaster, and Marlowe's lover. The poet was homosexual. At the time, Marlowe was about to be tried for possessing blasphemous writings denying the divinity of Jesus. One theory has it that he was killed on Walsingham's instructions to avoid scandals and revelations. A modern writer, the American Calvin Hoffman, has advanced the extraordinary theory that Marlowe did not really die. His death was faked. Another man was killed in his place. Marlowe escaped abroad and continued to write great dramas under the name of William Shakespeare. Hoffman's book, Murder of the Man Called Shakespeare, is a fascinating piece of detection, but not convincing. There are many people who believe that Mozart's early death at the age of 36 was murder. The Vienna of that period, the late 18th century, was awash with petty rivalries, and one of the men who plotted against Mozart was another composer, Antonio Salieri. Mozart became ill in 1791 and was convinced that he was being poisoned. His death certificate stated that the cause of death was severe miliary fever, which causes a rash with small lumps. Other contemporary accounts say he died of a deposit in the head, a violent grip, a dropsy of the heart, and kidney failure. More than 30 years later, a Vienna newspaper reported that Salieri had confessed to murdering Mozart by poison and had then attempted to commit suicide by cutting his throat. Salieri died 2 years later after a long illness, and the press again reported that his confession was in a church archive. It has never been found, and there's no proof that he ever made such a confession, or, if he did, that it was true. However, there can be no doubt whatsoever concerning the death of the composer Anton Webern, who died with three bullets in him on September the 15th, 1945. Webern, born in Austria in 1883, became a pupil of the controversial abstract composer Schoenberg, most of whose music is severely intellectual and totally lacking in melody. Webern began composing according to Schoenberg's 12-tone system. His works are extremely terse and difficult, and there are often long silences between the notes. In the 1930s, Schoenberg had to flee to America. Webern, being non-Jewish, had nothing to fear from the Nazis, but his jagged, incomprehensible music was regarded as anti-German. In 1945, he left his home at Mödling and went to live with his son-in-law, a man named Mattel, in Mittisil. Mattel was highly unpopular with the American occupying forces because he ran a black market in currency. On September the 15th, the American forces began to tighten up security regulations. A strict curfew had been imposed, and Mattel was deliberately not told. American soldiers surrounded his house. Webern strolled out in the dusk for a smoke, and an American soldier fired, hitting him three times. Webern died shortly afterwards. The American soldier alleged that he had fired in self-defence because Webern had attacked him with an iron bar. Webern's wife was refused a pension or damages. Fortunately, most artists, even if prone to self-pity, are not born victims, so cases like Webern's are almost as rare as cases like Lasnier and Hirasawa. For humanity, this is just as well. The world may not always love its creative geniuses, but they are the people we can spare the least.